This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
And I'm Deborah Bell.
Oops. Sorry, I forgot to press the button. Try it again.
No, you don't.
Yes, I did.
No, you didn't.
I sure did.
Okay.
Press the button.
Start from the beginning.
Start from the beginning.
Jack, this is Jack Walensky.
There you go.
Jennifer Renee.
Deborah Bell.
Glenn Holt.
And this is
Take
Brian Lemieux.
And on tonight's show, well, actually, first a programming announcement. Queer Voices will be preempted next week by Pacifica's coverage of the Green Party convention from Chicago, Illinois. And then after that, the plan is to move Queer Voices 1 hour later in the evening so that we will be starting here at 9 p.m. on Monday nights. So more about that later in the program. So, on tonight, Tim Brookover will be here to talk about his 7 years as editor of Outsmart magazine. Brian Pavinka talks with David Bermudez. David Bermudez is the winner of the 2008 Pride Idol contest. He is a native New Yorker, and he's been trying to break into the music business for a few years. So, apparently, winning the Pride Idol title has opened some doors for him. From This Way Out, we have News Wrap in the first hour, and in the second hour, gender issues are getting more and more exposure in the popular media, but that doesn't necessarily translate into more space for transgender people to speak for themselves. It's a look at transgender roles in the media. But first, our political correspondent David Elliott joins us from Washington, D.C. with his Inside the Beltway and Beyond report. David.
Hello, David.
This is Jennifer. David, are you there?
I am here, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm quite well. What's going on?
I didn't even remind you.
Well, you know, I caught the intro. I think I started saying hello to you folks before I got chimed in, but I know that Jennifer and Glenn and Deb and Jack are all there, and good evening and hello, Queer Voices.
Hello to you.
Yeah. And also, Brian Levinka is in the studio.
And I didn't get that, Deb. Who was that?
Brian Levinka.
Brian, I'm sorry I missed you.
You'd love Brian. We all do. He's been a real plus.
He's so cute.
Well, he's cute, plus he's been a great addition to the program.
Oh, shucks.
So what's going on inside and or outside the Beltway, David?
Well, you know, folks, last time I joined you 1 month ago, last time I came on the show, I asked the question, would we ever, ever, ever have a Democratic nominee for president?
What a difference a month makes.
Well, and now, with almost exactly 4 months until the election, give or take a couple of days, we have one. It's, of course, Barack Obama versus John McCain, with two largely irrelevant third-party candidates running, Bob Barr and Ralph Nader. So I'd like to start out tonight by setting the table, if I may. As it stands now, and this could change, Barack Obama is headed for a significant victory in the Electoral College. Now, a month ago, Obama and McCain were virtually tied in the polls. Then the Democratic primary ended. Hillary Clinton stepped up and endorsed Barack Obama. And today, according to about all of the public opinion surveys that are out there, Obama is up, by about an average of 6 points nationwide. But more importantly, Obama is holding all of the states that Democrats won in 2004, yet he is expanding the playing field in traditionally red states. He is 5 points ahead in Montana. He is way ahead in Colorado. He has a huge lead in New Mexico, which has accurately chosen 22 of the past 24 elections in terms of the presidential race. He's either tied or leading in Virginia. He is within striking distance in Georgia and in North Carolina. And believe it or not, he is only 2 points down in North Dakota. Now, last time I canvassed North Dakota, they only have like 37 Democrats up there. So what's going on? So if the election were held today, it would be about, in terms of the popular vote, 53% Obama, 47% McCain, not accounting for maybe 1.5% of Barr and Ralph Nader getting, you know, a little bit of the protest vote. But the Electoral College vote would not be nearly as close. Indeed, it would be more like Obama picking up about 61% of Electoral College votes versus 39% for McCain. In other words, it would be an Electoral College landslide. Now, that's today. And, of course, the election is 4 months from now. It's not today. So what's going to decide this election? Well, first, if nothing changes in the next 4 months, and we all know that something will change, Obama wins handily. But I will submit to you that in a typical presidential or senatorial election, three things matter. And I'd like to walk through those, if I may.
Please do.
First, issue environment. On the issues of the day, the economy, gas prices, health care for all, or Iraq, which party is ahead? I could argue with you that on the first three of those issues, the economy, gas prices, and health care, Democrats have about a 20 to 25 point lead polling wise. And on the issue of Iraq, it's close, but Democrats are ahead.
Okay.
The second most important thing in considering, you know, looking ahead to who might win a presidential or senatorial election, voter intensity. Are Democrats or are Republicans more determined to go out and vote for their candidate this November? Now, in a landslide, polls are telling us that Democrats are more incentivized, if that's the word, more inclined.
It's a word now.
It's a word. You made it up.
We'll
put it in Wikipedia.
I don't think I'm nailing it, Deb. It's incentive.
It's just difficult to say.
Democrats are just a lot more eager. You know, they're the ones who are getting into their cars every Tuesday and driving to the polling places just to make sure that there's not an election going on that day that nobody told them about.
Oh, God.
That's me. Every Tuesday, boy, I'm there.
And well, you know, through the 70s and through the 80s, it was Republicans who were doing that. Democrats win, because this is a nonpartisan radio show, on the second point. The third issue that determines the outcome of a presidential election or a statewide senatorial election is the ground game. Which campaign has the most money to spend on TV, or which campaign has the best field organization? And again, guess what? There is no question who wins this competition. Obama and McCain right now are about even on money in the bank. But Obama has a far superior ground game. I mean, take Texas, for instance. Obama is sending 17 organizers into Texas for the November election. Now, granted, that's not a whole lot for a state the size of Texas, but I expect McCain to dispatch maybe 1 to 3 people to Texas for November. And it's going to kind of be interesting to see who they send, because it undoubtedly is going to be folks who have displeased their bosses. If you're a Republican organizer, you don't want to be sent to Texas. You want to be sent to something that's considered a swing state, like Ohio or Pennsylvania or, you know, Missouri, something like that.
Well, why are you saying that McCain would only send that number because they think they would have Texas anyway?
Absolutely, Deb. McCain has to concentrate on a George W. Bush strategy of 2000 and 2004. He's got to concentrate on Florida. He's got to concentrate on Ohio. He's got to win New Mexico. He's got to win Missouri. He's got to win those close swing states. He cannot afford to dispatch money, ad dollars, staff to states that have to be safe for him.
But if he doesn't send some resources to Texas, he could lose Texas.
Well, you know, there is that. You know, Jack, when I was younger...
This is Jennifer.
I'm sorry, Jennifer. I always do that. I always mistake you for Jack, and I apologize for that.
I apologize, Jack.
She's much prettier than Jack.
Yeah, when I was younger, I used to play this board game called Risk. Did any of you ever play
it? Oh, I love that game.
I love Risk. You know, it's basically this game of world domination. And, you know, and I mean that in the, you know...
Go ahead.
Normal sense. You get a certain number of armies, and you put them on this country or this country and this country, and you sort of, you know, play out. You know, it's a war game, you know, which countries you're going to try to take over. And really, when you look at the 50 states, it's the exact same thing when it comes to the presidential race. McCain has to decide which states he's going to play in, which states he's going to contest, and Obama has to do the same thing. But Obama's going to have a lot more money and a lot more volunteers, so Obama is going to have the ability to expand the playing field in a way that McCain will not be able to do. And that is really, after everything is said and done 4 months from now, that's going to be the story of this presidential election, coupled, of course, with the great army of Democrats that Obama was able to register on his way to the nomination. That's going to be what's going to make a difference. Now, I want to say one thing in closing, if I may, because this is something that's kind of unique to this election. This election is not really, not actually, between Obama and McCain. At least right now it's not. McCain is not really in the game right now. Rather, the election is really between Obama and Obama. If Obama keeps running an effective campaign, he doesn't flip-flop too much, he doesn't make too many mistakes, it's game over. He wins. On the other hand, if he does make a bunch of mistakes, verbal gaffes, bunch of flip-flops, then he gives McCain the opportunity to get back into the race, and then it could actually become Obama versus McCain.
Well, and I have to ask you about that, David. I mean, Obama's now supporting the spy bill. He seems to be moving to the right in a lot of issues.
Well, you know, a couple of things about that, Jack. First, a lot of people, perhaps mistakenly, assumed from the get-go that because Obama was campaigning as the agent of change, that meant that he was campaigning as the agent of the left. And they're not necessarily one and the same. And the second thing to consider is, look at history. Candidates, nominees from both parties, traditionally move toward the center if they were ever anywhere outside of the center to begin with, once they get the nomination. You know, I give you Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1932. He was the governor of New Mexico. I mean, excuse me, he was the governor
of New Mexico. That's a surprise.
My God. And he was the overwhelming favorite, you know, from day one. And he ran his campaign like it. He ran the most conservative general election campaign you've ever seen. He gets elected. he turns out to be our most progressive president.
So you just don't know for sure until...
It's just pretty typical that that's what they're going to do. They're going to tack to the center. Is that what you're saying? That we should have expected this?
You know, it takes a somewhat unusual breed of human being to run for president, in my mind. To me, they're all a little bit weird, you know? we're going to be disappointed by Barack Obama. We're going to be disappointed by him once, twice, thrice. But at the end of the day, Obama knows that there are a lot of Democrats out there who realize that the choice is between him and John McCain.
Well, and the reality is also that he's got so much cleaning up to do.
Yeah, the next president faces a huge cleanup job. That's for sure. Can his swing to the center or his more right to the right positions be ones that might alienate some of the people that have been supporting him?
Well, Jennifer, that's a fair question. I mean, we can take comfort from the fact that he just came out rather strongly against the anti-gay marriage initiative that's on the ballot in California. Within 24 hours of when John McCain was meeting with religious fundamentalists in Ohio who were telling him, hey, McCain, if you don't speak out more strongly on anti-gay issues, we're not going to support you and we're not going to get our people out to the polls. So, you know, I want to say again, I think that Obama is going to be great on some issues at some times, and I think that there are times when he's going to disappoint us. Keep in mind...
Well, isn't he saying one man, one woman, that's what marriage is? Isn't that still his tack?
That's what he believes legally.
Yeah.
At the same time, he was careful to come out against the proposed ballot initiative in California, which, if it passes, will not only, until it's struck down, strike down same-sex marriages, but will also put in danger all sorts of civil unions involving both same-sex couples and unmarried heterosexual couples, mm-hmm. which is a whole larger issue.
Those heterosexual couples have the option of marriage, and same-sex couples do not.
You're right, but
of course I am.
Yeah, well, you are. But
don't argue with her.
But I might bring into focus. What if you have two elderly roommates who have been best friends for life, for whatever reason they've decided not to marry. I don't know, maybe one's Catholic and they couldn't have a previous marriage annulled. Maybe it was a lifestyle decision they made. And should they be punished simply because they decided not to take that step of marriage? It's the same argument that, lesbian, gay, transgendered people make. It's just in a different, more majoritarian setting, I think. I think actually we're saying about the same thing. We're just saying it in different ways.
Well, no, I don't know that they should be punished, but I'm saying they still have that option. And so if they make that decision, they have to live with the consequences. I know a situation where there was a man and woman who were living together, and they did not officially declare themselves to be common law married or otherwise married in the state of Texas because of her disability benefits. But then he died in an accident, and suddenly she was the equivalent of a widow, but without any benefits from, his Social Security or anything. But that was a choice they made for her to get the disability benefits.
And that is a tragic choice for anybody to have to make, regardless of anything.
That's true.
You know, gay, lesbian, transgender, straight, whatever. I feel for that couple.
Yes. Well, David, we we'll look forward to seeing as things develop. We'll see what next month will bring to us and look forward to your Inside the Beltway and Beyond report. You have joined a new organization. Give us the name again.
Sure. I'm at U.S. Action. Our website is usaction.org. And I want to tell you that tomorrow we are having press conferences in 52 cities across the United States, in a total of 38 states, to launch a $45 million campaign demanding affordable, quality health care for every American.
Yay!
I'm one of those people.
Yes.
All right.
well, those 42 million.
Thank you, David Elliott, for being with us on Queer Voices. And now we're going to News Wrap from This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Steve Levin.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 5th, 2008. Hundreds of LGBT people and their supporters took to the streets of Calcutta, Bangalore, and New Delhi on June 29th in the largest displays of pride ever held in India. Some marchers in each of the three cities wore rainbow-colored masks to hide their identities. But one participant, openly gay lawyer Alok Gupta, told the Associated Press that this is a national coming-out party. He called the overriding demand of the marchers a simple thing. We are seeking the right to love. Activists have mounted a protracted legal challenge to Section 377 of India's Penal Code, which criminalizes consensual adult same-gender sex as carnal intercourse against the order of nature, punishable by up to 10 years in prison. While it's a rarely enforced remnant of British colonial rule, India's conservative government believes it's representing predominant social attitudes by defending the retention of the law. Opponents charge that it implicitly supports discrimination and is used to bully and extort LGBT people. The country's high court on July 4th agreed with the NAS Foundation, the non-governmental LGBT and HIV/AIDS advocacy group that's challenging Section 377, to fast-track the case and scheduled a full hearing for July 21st.
LGBT people and their allies also marched with pride in two European cities this week. In the German capital, the parade started for the first time in what was formerly East Berlin, winding its way to the Victory Column in the west of the city. Tens of thousands refused to let occasional showers rain on their parade, and a rose was placed at the recently dedicated monument to LGBT victims of the Nazi regime.
In Paris, popular openly gay mayor Bertrand Delanoy was among a half million people celebrating LGBT pride under a river of rainbow flags. He's been mentioned as a possible Socialist Party candidate for president in 2012 and has stated publicly that he thinks France is ready for an openly gay head of state.
At the annual Pride March in New York City, home of the 1969 Stonewall Riots, which Pride events around the world now commemorate, crowds cheered Governor David Paterson a month after he directed state agencies to provide marriage benefits to same-gender couples who've been legally wed elsewhere. He was the first New York governor to participate in that city's Pride parade.
Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick was also warmly received at the annual Pride Parade in Boston in mid-June, where he marched with his youngest daughter, Catherine, who'd come out as lesbian a few weeks earlier. Tens of thousands also celebrated Pride in mid-June in Indianapolis, Indiana.
The traditional Dykes on Bikes led off the 38th annual Pride Parade in San Francisco on June 29th, but this year, many of them wore bridal veils, wedding gowns, and tossed bouquets in celebration of the recent California Supreme Court marriage equality ruling, which took effect on June 16th. Thousands of same-gender couples have already married in the state, despite a looming November ballot initiative that would overturn the high court ruling and constitutionally ban them. Arizona's legislature voted this week to put a similar proposal on their state ballot. Voters will also decide on a constitutional same-gender marriage ban this November in Florida.
Members of the Canadian Armed Forces, marching in uniform for the first time, were among about 5,000 participants at Toronto's LGBT Pride Parade on June 29th, before an estimated 1 million spectators. Military personnel also staffed a recruitment booth at the parade's starting point. Canada lifted its ban on military service by open gays and lesbians in 1992.
But LGBT people and their supporters had a difficult time celebrating Pride in three Eastern European cities this week. The Associated Press reported that dozens of protesters attacked the July 5th march in Budapest, pelting participants with eggs, bottles, and rocks, and throwing bricks and Molotov cocktails at police officers who were guarding them. At least 45 protesters were arrested, and two officers were hurt in the melees. Two gay businesses in the Hungarian capital were firebombed earlier in the week in advance of the Pride March. No one was hurt by a gasoline bomb that exploded in the basement of Action, a gay bar, but fumes from the subsequent multiple firebombing of Magnum, a gay sauna, injured at least one. Phone calls to the venues right before each bombing warned people to evacuate, but LGBT activists called them terrorist attacks. Pride parades had been held for several years in Budapest without incident until last year, when ultra-nationalists and skinheads attacked some of the marchers with bottles, smoke bombs, and Molotov cocktails. While police officials had expressed concerns about violence at this year's Pride March, city officials nevertheless issued a permit to a right-wing group to hold a counter-demonstration along the same route. A message on the group's website said, "We will not tolerate foreign perverts of whatever color forcing their alien and sick world onto Hungary."
About 20 people were hurt as a mob of 150 nationalist extremists launched a tear gas attack on the first ever Pride parade in the Czech Republic on June 28th. Two Pride marchers and one police officer in the country's second largest city of Brno required emergency medical treatment. Various reports said that from 3 to 7 anti-queer protesters were arrested. The attack ended the planned two-hour parade after about 20 minutes. The route had already been shortened after protesters threw eggs and fireworks into a crowd of about 500 participants who'd gathered at the starting point of the march. Czech-born lesbian tennis legend Martina Navratilova and the country's human rights minister, Zamila Stelikova, reportedly attended, but were not injured.
Riot police arrested about 60 far-right demonstrators who were protesting Bulgaria's first-ever Pride March in the capital city of Sofia on the same day. One man threw a gasoline bomb near the marchers, numbering about 150 people, while others hurled eggs, rocks, and bottles at them, but no serious injuries were reported. Religious leaders and right-wing groups had demanded that the march be banned. Even socialist Prime Minister Sergei Stanishev said he was uncomfortable with what he called the manifestation and demonstration of such orientations. The far-right Bulgarian National Union had called for open resistance to the march with a week-long campaign featuring posters that read, "Be intolerant, be normal." The group's leader was among those arrested.
In other news, what some critics are calling a church within a church was created at the conclusion this week of the Global Anglican Future Conference, a gathering in Jerusalem of hundreds of bishops, clergy, and laypeople, mostly from the church's African, Latin American, and Asian regions, who oppose LGBT supportive actions taken by the North American branches of the Worldwide Christian Consortium. The new body, called the Fellowship of Confessing Anglicans, will have its own bishops, clergy, theological colleges, and will embrace disaffected Canadian Anglican and U.S. Episcopal congregations who also oppose the queer-inclusive paths their branches have taken, including the consecration in 2003 of openly gay New Hampshire Episcopal Bishop Gene Robinson. While the fellowship, composed of some 300 of Anglicanism's 800 bishops, insists that it wants to remain part of the 80-million-member communion, formation of the new group represents a direct challenge to the authority of the church's titular leader, Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams. A statement issued by the breakaway bishops said that, "We do not accept that Anglican identity is determined necessarily through recognition by the Archbishop of Canterbury." Williams, who's unsuccessfully tried to walk a theological tightrope and hold the communion together, criticized the new group, saying that to improvise solutions that may seem to be effective for some in the short term will continue to create more problems than they solve. The impact of the split will likely be evident at the Lambeth Conference, a once-a-decade Anglican policymaking gathering scheduled for later this month in London. Several prominent conservative bishops are boycotting the meeting.
Retired Republican U.S. Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina, who many believe to have been the most homophobic politician in modern American history, died at the age of 86 this week. He infamously charged that the New York Times and Washington Post are both infested with homosexuals themselves. Just about every person down there is a homosexual or lesbian. Commenting about gays and AIDS, he said that it's their deliberate, disgusting, revolting conduct that is responsible for the disease. Few in the LGBT communities will mourn him, and fewer still will miss him.
The so-called Marriage Protection Amendment, another attempt to define matrimony as exclusively heterosexual in the U.S. Constitution, is being introduced in Congress, a predictable Republican tactic during an election year. Two defenders of heterosexual marriage are among its co-sponsors, U.S. Senators David Vitter of Louisiana, identified last year as a client of a major Washington, D.C. prostitution ring, and Larry Craig of Idaho, who still maintains his heterosexuality after infamously being busted last year for soliciting an undercover policeman in a Minneapolis airport restroom.
And finally, the rabidly homophobic American Family Association distributed a very queer Associated Press story about U.S. Olympic sprinter Tyson Gay on its online One News Now network this week. While the AFA is not identified anywhere on the site as its registered owner, the group always changes the word gay in the so-called news stories it posts to homosexual. Although the Associated Press was credited as the source, the AFA rewrite, which has since been taken down, was headlined, "Homosexual eases into 100 final at Olympic events," and included such gems as Tyson Homosexual was a blur in blue with red and white diagonal stripes across the front, along with matching shoes, all in a tribute to 1936 Olympic star Jesse Owens. And Homosexual qualified for his first Summer Games team and served notice that he's certainly someone to watch in Beijing.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 5th, 2008, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Steve Levin.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
And coming up next on Queer Voices, Tim Brookhover. from 2005. That was The Gossip, Standing in the Way of Control. This is Queer Voices.
Well, with us in our studio this evening is Tim Brookover, who has
Good evening.
Been the editor of Outsmart for the past 7 years and is leaving.
Forever.
Mm-hmm. 7 years. And the magazine's like, what, 12, 11, 10?
Actually, it's in its 15th year of publication.
Wow, yes. So you've been there almost half its lifespan.
Well, you know, now that you mention it. You're right. I hadn't thought of it that way, but Jack, you're correct.
And we all know, all of us, I guess, here pretty much know the struggles of doing a local publication, small staff.
Mm-hmm.
Yet Outsmart has really been a quality magazine over the years. And, you know, I know there's been some years there where it was tough to do the glossy paper, but we're back to the glossy paper again.
Right.
And, it's, you know, in fact, for the June issue, I guess that's usually your biggest issue every year.
That's always the biggest issue every year.
It's Pride.
June issue, which is Pride, and then the October issue, which is our gayest and greatest Reader's Choice issue. But I would say probably June issue is certainly one of the two biggest ones.
So, and where do you all try to focus? I mean, you're trying to cover the entire community, GLBT, and then you're trying to cover, you know, all different aspects of it. So where do you start?
Well, certainly, you know, the Outsmart focus has always focused on the GLBT community, people, events, activities, always are incredibly vibrant nonprofit and fundraising efforts. And then also spotlight, you know, some individuals who are doing some particularly interesting things or, of course, involved in activities in the news or events in the news. And there are always many of those. It seems more and more there are things to cover. And that's always a challenge to keep up with. But a good problem to have, because, you know, particularly now that there's more and more good news coming along, you know, the events, the marriage events in California being a great recent example, and some of the successes we've had.
And we may win some political, we may be winning some elections now.
Isn't that an interesting turn?
Yes.
Well, also, when the Houston Voice closed, y'all took up a little bit of that slack trying to cover with a community calendar and some other items that helped.
Well, that was certainly the loss of the Voice was a terrible loss for the community. And those of us who are in the community, both, of course, on the media side, but then those of us who are, many of us are also involved in community nonprofit organizations, realize more and more what a terrible loss that was, not having that weekly source of information. I mean, having, you know, those of us at Outsmart, of course, like to think that everybody read Outsmart and loved Outsmart and studied it diligently when it came out. But the fact of the matter is that came out once a month. And even though we had a relatively short deadline compared to other monthly publications that might have to complete their magazines 3 or 4 months in advance, still we couldn't report on things up to the minute. And then, of course, once the magazine's published, it's done for the month. You can't come back the next week and say, oh, we need to follow up with that event, or there's a rally, or, you know, we need to tell you about this, you know, hate crime that's happened. I think you'll see, as Outsmart goes forward, you're going to see more of that. You're going to see some changes on the website with some more original and updated content, which will be wonderful, and a challenge to do. But still, that can't replace the weekly newspaper. I mean, even in this day where so many of us get our news and information online, including myself, there's still something about having that paper that you pick up once a week and read what's going on and sort of get a recap of the events. And we probably won't see that again.
Well, Outsmart is also unique in what it does, because there aren't too many magazines like that around the country.
There are very few, and I think that's certainly an indication of how difficult it is. And it's very much a tribute to outsmart that it's been around for so long, and, you know, and flourished, and survived some of the lean years.
Sure.
But there are very few. I mean, someone who I was speaking with recently, in fact, from San Francisco, you know, the holy city, again, was mentioning that San Francisco doesn't have an analogous magazine. Of course, they have a newspaper, and they probably have many, you know, some bar publications and things of that nature, but they don't have a weekly, I mean, a monthly sort of general interest magazine, which always surprised me in a city like San Francisco.
Well, the unique thing about the magazine is that you can have longer articles or even some thought pieces,
mm-hmm.
and analysis of where we're going, which you couldn't do in a newspaper.
No, that's true. You can't. And certainly in a weekly, which thankfully I haven't worked at in a long time, but you've got to move so quickly. And you don't have time to, you know, sit back and do those kind of things. Now, certainly, I mean, if you probably worked at a weekly with, you know, an enormous staff and resources, you could, but that's something that we're certainly not going to see in the GLBT community, where, you know, resources are always lean and operations are always leaner.
I was also very impressed, and still am impressed, with the photography within the magazine. You know, considering it's a local magazine, it's really superb.
Well, thanks. I'm glad you.
Hey, you even made me look good.
We are very fortunate, and I know that going forward, the magazine will continue to be fortunate to have so many talented photographers who are willing to take pictures for the magazine, some of whom make a great deal of money with their other clients, and who, you know, they don't work for OutSmart for free, but we're not throwing, you know, big bushels of money at anybody. So they were working for the magazine for the love of the magazine and for the opportunity, and then also for the opportunity, you know, to have their work featured, you know, in another venue. We know that's obvious. There's some worth to that. But really, I think certainly a number of them, you know, particularly talking about some very high-quality photographers like John Conroy, worked for the magazine because he enjoyed it, and it was, you know, for the love of the magazine, and we always appreciated that.
Over your lifespan there, what are some of the articles that you're very proud of?
You know, Jack, there were a lot. And I was thinking about this the other day. One of the single articles that I was proudest of, or a collection of articles, was our coverage after the, or just prior to and just after the Lawrence versus Texas decision, the Supreme Court decision in 2003 that overturned anti-gay sodomy laws in Texas and then around the country. We had some very strong coverage around that, and we were very fortunate in that we got one of our reporters, Joseph Molnar, actually into the Supreme Court chamber.
Really?
Yes. And
wow.
He was excited and reported on that afterwards.
I bet he was comparing notes with Nina Totenberg.
Probably so. But that was very thrilling, and I was very proud of that. And then the magazine's always had political coverage. But
well, and I got to say that right after the 2004 election, where we were all very depressed, I thought some of the articles, there was two articles in there, and I know one was locally done, and that would just sort of bring me some solace, because, you know, it's just like, how do you continue after losing in 2004?
Right. Well, that's interesting you should say that, and I'm glad that you remembered that, because that's something that we wrestled with, and I presented that to the staff after the election. I said, you know, I think we need to acknowledge that this was a real loss. How do you go forward after that? And I think that was very powerful, and I think that was part of some of the best work the magazine's done in recent years, some of our political coverage. You can always do better, but I think, you know, we did a pretty good job, and also allowed a number of different voices in the community in and, you know, have a say, or, you know, get involved in the coverage. And then, of course, at the same time, we were fortunate in that the number of openly GLBT candidates you know, began to increase. I mean, we still aren't flooding the ballot, but, you know, we certainly have more. I mean, I think this last cycle we had, what, three or four mm-hmm. That were open. I mean, we all know that there are some who aren't, but that's been exciting to cover. And you know, one of the things I was looking forward to as the political season went on was, you know, some of the political coverage we could do leading up to the presidential election. But of course, a lot of that's, you know, will go forward, and I think will be very exciting.
How difficult was it to find writers?
That was very difficult.
Well, and to get writers to actually follow through was probably even more difficult.
That was very difficult. In fact, it was more difficult in my experience to find writers than photographers. We ended up having a core of you know, good photographers, some of whom were available more readily than others. But a number of the writers who worked with us weren't always available, the good ones I'm thinking of. And then some, you know, moved away. That doesn't mean that they couldn't write for us anymore, but they weren't here locally to do sort of local, mm-hmm. the local type of reporting that we like. And almost all of our writers that worked with us, they had other full-time jobs.
Sure.
And so they, you know, with very limited time and limited energy, and that was a real challenge. And I know it was a challenge for them too, because, you know, they would be writing for Outsmart, but at the same time they would be, you know, their real paid
right. job.
One's first priority is always
their bread and butter,
you know,
yes.
That bread and butter job. And so that's, you know, that is a challenge. And you're always looking to bring in some new talent, some new writers, and a few very good ones, you know, popped up recently, and hopefully they'll continue with the magazine, bringing some fresh voices, and that's always exciting to find those writers, or in some cases, of course, the writers find the magazine and you know, turn out to really be important contributors.
And, you know, how do you look, you know, as you look to choose some of the stories that you handle? I mean, certainly after an election or Lawrence, but then you've got lots of months in between. You know, mm-hmm. of course, there's Pride and there's the holiday season.
Right.
But how do you come up with the ideas of trying to cover stuff that, and especially, you know, I mean, we sort of have the challenge, too, of events that happen every year. You know, you want to look at a fresh angle.
Right. Well, what I always like to do is I liked to focus on individuals. And a lot of times you can tell the story of an event or an activity, particularly something that happens every year, Pride, the Black Tie Dinner, you know, the HRC Gala, on and on. You can tell that story through an individual. Now then, of course, the key is finding that individual. And those of us in the community know, a lot of the same people do the same work year after year, and thank goodness for that. But you like to find new people, kind of bring new people along and give new people a chance to get some attention. And I mean, if they're doing something worthwhile. So that was something that we did a lot of, covering individuals. And then, of course, you know, there are so many wonderful cultural events in Houston, many of them, you know, certainly of interest to the GLBT community are strictly GLBT, that we covered a lot of that. And the magazine's always had a very strong entertainment focus, entertainment, arts, cultural events. And I think that's something that our readers have enjoyed, and we're able to cover some things that the more mainstream media might not cover. Although
right.
I've noticed recently that they're, you know, the Chronicle's come along, thank goodness for that, but they're covering a lot of the same kind of things that we've covered, whereas in the past they might not have covered some of those more, you know, gay things.
Well, we're definitely living in a new age in the media.
Absolutely.
You know, that the Chronicle or any major newspaper is not what it used to be.
Right.
You know, people aren't buying it. Luckily, they are still reading it online, or a lot of people are, but there's an awful lot of people that you would think are really educated about what's going on in the community, and they... You know, they miss it. It's also, you know, a lot of the local media, they'd rather focus on national things rather than the local things, because nobody else in it, because it's easier. And the local things are what local media is supposed to be covering.
And I read an interesting article related to that, Jack, that is in one of the media websites that I occasionally look at. And, a self-appointed expert, I can't even remember where he was from some institute or think tank, was saying that one of the ways that print media, he's particularly talking about newspapers, will be able to survive is really adopting and pursuing that local focus, because that's what people want to read. Which isn't to say it all has to be soft news, but, you know, people want to read what's going on in their community. They don't, you know, if they want to read about the important events in Washington and in the world, which everybody should know about, they can go look at the New York Times.
Right, NPR, or
NPR.
You know, exactly, or the nightly news, you know. And it just gets me so upset when you're watching the local news that they're, you know, they're doing stories on national media rather than focusing it on. And you know, and I said this before, KUHF local news, why not do local news?
Right.
You know, but I'm really pleased of how, you know, the Outsmart has tried to do their best in covering this community, you know, with its understandable limitations of being a monthly publication.
Right. Well, thanks. And I think certainly the magazine's done a great job and did, you know, before I was around, and will continue to do that as it goes to its 15th anniversary next February. So that's exciting. And as I mentioned earlier, I think you'll see some more content on the website, you know, some more original content. I know that's something that's being worked on right now, which will bring even just an even richer experience to the publication. And I think that's exciting. I'll look forward to seeing that myself.
And where do you go from here?
Well, looking around, I have a few opportunities that I'm exploring, and I think it's going to be very exciting. And then I imagine I'll, you know, be keeping my hand in here and there. I'm not going anywhere. And I am remaining involved with the magazine as editor-at-large, which kind of is yet to be defined a little bit, but I'll be contributing work to the magazine in the future, you know, doing some writing. I was asked to do that, and of course I was very pleased to be asked, and definitely will want to do that. What exactly that will entail, keep reading Outsmart and you'll find out.
And what community organizations are you involved in?
I'm on the board of directors of the Houston GLBT Community Center.
And what's the newest update going on with them?
The latest update, and I laugh because, as Jack and I know, this has been a saga. We are the community center which is currently housed in offices at 3400 Montrose on the second floor.
In that wonderful building.
In that wonderful, what I call the building that nobody loved. It's the Sky Bar building, for those of you who might not know it. We are planning to move. The current plan, and I only say current just because the T's haven't been crossed and the I's haven't been dotted, but is to move into 401 Bernard, which is the new building where the Montrose Counseling Center is. Well, it's the new Montrose Counseling Center building. And we'll move on to the first floor, where they're making some space available to community organizations to rent. So that's still the plan. It's been a little bit slowed up, but we're still working on that, probably looking toward moving very into the summer, maybe even early fall, because that's right around the corner. Then I'm also on the board of directors of the Houston Transgender Unity Committee, which is the nonprofit consortium of the many transgender organizations in the Houston-Galveston area. And that's a great organization, and I've been honored to be involved with that group. And then I'm on the Board of Governors, which is an honorary, which is an advisory board of the Gulf Coast Archive and Museum of GLBT History. But the nice thing about being on the Board of Governors is it means no meetings.
Well, thank you very much, Tim. We appreciate it, and we want to keep this door open to you. If you
been honored to be invited on. Thank you so much, and I'm always happy to be on the show. You guys do such a terrific job, and Queer Voices now more than ever is such a vital source of information for our community because we're losing those.
Yes, and we're moving an hour later.
That's what I saw.
Which we're not real happy about, but life goes on, and we'll do the best we can.
Life does.
Tim Brookover, thank you very much for joining us on Queer Voices.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't tell me I have stayed too late. I am going to finish what we started. I have watched too many days go by, and I just refuse to let another pass me by. And I will close the door on this. It never should have happened. I just get sucked in by girls like you. Don't bat your eyes at me that way. Can't you see that it is just not working? No more long distance email chats and waiting for the phone to ring that never does. And I will close the door on this. It never should have happened. I just get there's a million other girls who might fall prey to you. Won't you please leave me alone, 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 alone? You have broken me to tears and not much sleep, you know. Rip the skin right from my bones. Friends, as the conquered prize you won again, taught me just to see if I will break, just to see if you still have the power it will take. And I will close the door on this. It never should have happened. I just get sucked in by girls like. Close the door on this. It never should have happened. I just get sucked in by girls like you. Like you. Like you. Like you. Like you. Like you. Like you.
Was that song written specifically for Brian Levinka? I don't think so. That was Ann Myers, Girls Like You. And coming up in the second hour of Queer Voices, Brian Levinka talks with David Bermudez, the winner of the 2008 Pride Idol contest. And I think we're going to try to squeeze an a cappella piece out of him. That will be interesting. Stay tuned.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be. If you attended the Pride Festival a couple of weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, you might have seen and heard our next guest, the winner of the Pride Idol Contest, David Bermudez. Say hello.
Hello, hello. How's everybody doing?
We're good. I'm so glad to get the winner here. I understand it's quite a long process to become the Pride Idol. Can you tell us how that worked out for you?
It is. Basically, it starts off with filling out an application, mm-hmm. Pretty much getting down all the info, the basics, and pretty much giving them a reason as to why you would want to go ahead and try and do this.
So you have to have some sort of Pride passion.
Absolutely. It has a lot to do with pride. Obviously, it has a lot to do with the passion for singing.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely a passion for, I guess, the small little bit or the small little recognition that you get that's almost like American Idol. So
small? You performed in front of thousands of people.
I know. For me, it's huge. I mean, for other people that, I guess, follow American Idol, this would be on a much smaller scale, but for me this is absolutely huge.
Now this is the second year that they had the Pride Idol, is that correct?
Absolutely, this is the second annual Pride Idol, actually it was such an honor to be a part of it. It was so cool to do it. And
now, were there different rounds? I know they had rounds at Guava Lamp.
Yes, it was basically 6 weeks.
6 weeks. So you
5 preliminary rounds and then the final round.
And how did do people clap or did they, how do they?
Basically, they have 3 judges,
uh-huh.
That account for 75% of your final score for the evening. And then this year, what they tried that was something new was that they added text messaging as part of the voting.
Oh, that's very
right.
American Idol, yeah.
Yeah, and so the audience actually accounted for 25% of the final score. And sometimes that was the deciding factor in the course of the evening.
Well, could you get your friends like to just start texting whenever?
Yeah, absolutely. They, at the end of each night, as soon as the last person is done performing, they give everybody a window of about 10 to 15 minutes, and they say, text now. They give everybody a designated number, and you can text them as many times as you want.
Do you know how many total contestants they had this year?
Started off with 7.
Okay.
Started off with 7, and each week somebody else got bumped off, mm-hmm. until the final 2 were left standing.
Now, did you try out last year?
I didn't try out last year. I didn't even know about it until it had already begun.
I see. So, for our listeners out there, if you have this desire to be Pride Idol, do you just go and you sign up next year?
Basically, the information isn't updated yet, but it soon will be because it just ended a couple of weeks ago. But you can visit www.HoustonPrideIdol.com.
Okay.
And I definitely have to give a big thanks to Frankie Quijano, who is the coordinator for Pride Idol. He has done an amazing job with this, and it just keeps growing and growing.
I see. So what are some of the things that, as the winner of Pride Idol, have you reaped?
Well, I actually, like you mentioned earlier, I got to perform on the main stage right before the parade started.
Mm-hmm.
I also had my own car in the parade.
A little convertible, I'm
yes,
sure.
A little Mustang convertible.
Did you do your little model wave?
I did, of course, you know.
Now, did you have a crown?
I didn't have a crown,
oh, okay.
And I didn't have a sash, but that's okay. I had the title, so that was good. And I also get $1,000 worth of recording studio time with Alan Lett Productions.
Okay.
And I got 2 round trip tickets on Southwest to anywhere they fly.
I see.
Yes,
I see.
Definitely.
So it's kind of, this is a big door opener for you.
Absolutely. I mean, like I said, for some people it might seem very minor, but for me this is huge. It's allowing me to go back into the studio and actually get a full-on demo recorded. It's giving me an opportunity to promote Pride Idol going into next year, mm-hmm. and make sure that it gets out there a lot more than it has been in the past. And yeah, this is big for me.
So is this your full-time job, or do you have is this
no,
on the side?
No, actually, the singing is my passion. It's, anybody who knows me knows that this is what drives me. But I work at MD Anderson, mm-hmm. Cancer Center. And I also
I've
sing.
Heard of them.
Yeah. And I also sing with a band. The band is called.
Go ahead and plug. Yeah.
Yeah. Music by Midstream.
Okay.
We're a party band. We do any bit of cover that you could possibly ask for. And you can visit our website at
www.musicbymidstream.com.
Musicbymidstream.com. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Let's see. So how did you get started in music? Was this from a small age, young age?
Wow. Yeah. When I was a kid, I grew up in New York City.
I would have never guessed. Forget about it. New York in the house.
I grew up in New York City, and I grew up in a Puerto Rican household. And, you know,
David is Puerto Rican, by the way.
And, you know, one of the first boy bands out there was Menudo.
Menudo.
Yeah,
Por supuesto.
Of course. And so as a kid, I knew that singing was a passion for me. And so it was like always, I have to try to get into Menudo. But
did you, like, put on the little Menudo outfits, the tight little shorts now?
No. But we would, on occasion, put on little concerts at home and, you know, kind of lip sync to all of the Menudo songs and try and pretend like we're a little mini Menudo.
Menudo Quito.
Menudo Quito.
Yes. So, of course, do you have, like, a MySpace page or anything that
I do. I do. MySpace.com/PRSinger.
PR Singer.
Yes. You can visit that. I'm actually updating it now. I'm trying to get some of the stuff that I've previously recorded on there so people can take a listen. And whenever I do record my stuff with Alan Lett, I'm definitely going to post some of that stuff up there.
So if we have any music producers out there that might be listening?
Yeah, definitely send them my way.
Yes. Now, do you have an email address?
I do have an email address, prdragon05@yahoo.com.
Okay, that can personally contact
yeah,
you.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, what sort of songs did you sing at the Pride Festival?
You know, at the Pride Festival, I try to touch on a lot of different genres of music because I don't ever want to be cast as a certain type of singer. Definitely, I have the more soulful voice. I grew up listening to and being inspired by pop and R&B, especially on the R&B side and gospel. But at the Pride Festival, I did a little George Michael, and I did a little El DeBarge. And then, of course, I brought it to the current American Idol, David Cook, and did some of that as well.
Very good, very good. Let's see. Who are some of your influences musically? I mean, who do you...
Wow. First and foremost, Donnie Hathaway is one of my biggest inspirations. One of my favorite songs by Donny Hathaway is A Song for You, and it's just something that I listened to when I was younger, and it's something that just kind of drew me into the music. Definitely Brian McKnight, mm-hmm. one of the classic guy singers out there with just an amazing voice. Luther Vandross, of course. Those are the ones that really inspired me to do mm-hmm. what I've been doing.
Now, our listeners may recognize you because you used to do karaoke at JR's.
I used to host karaoke along with Marsha Carlton at JR's, yes. Mm-hmm.
What happened to that?
Well, it got to a point where I needed to move on, mm-hmm. and I wanted to try other things, and I was actually in the process of getting my tonsils removed at a very late age.
Oh,
I don't recommend it to anybody.
Especially someone who sings.
Yeah, so it was a bit scary, and I didn't know how quickly I was going to recover from that. And I knew that being in a smoky bar at the time was not going to be the best environment for me. So.
Right. Do you have any advice for those listeners out there that want to break into the music and kind of... I'd read in the... there was a very nice write-up in the Chronicle last week in the preview section about how you had stage fright when you initially started singing.
Oh, wow, yeah. It was awful. When I was in school, it was okay. Whenever I performed, it was just awful. I would be overcome with anxiety. And so when I first moved here, I kind of overcame that stage fright by doing karaoke. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine told me that that was the way to do it, and I did. So when it came to performing and doing karaoke, it was pretty much gone. But whenever it came down to actually auditioning or, a competition, when it actually meant something, it would still be there.
Yeah.
And so this was kind of another stepping stone for me to try to kind of overcome that stage fright as far as competitions and auditioning is concerned.
So what's next for David Bermudez? What are your goals? Where do you want to see yourself in 5 years?
You know, I would love to have a record deal. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, one day at a time, and I'm looking at the foreseeable future, and that's definitely going into the studio and, you know, trying to put out a really good demo and see where it goes from there.
Yeah. I don't know if you watched the Lohan show where she's trying to record a demo. You sound like her.
Yeah.
Ali Lohan. She's in the studio recording.
And, you know, but I'm tired.
Exactly. Now, I read in your in the preview of in Chronicle that you attended a special high school in New York.
I did. I attended the LaGuardia High School for Music and Art and the Performing Arts, which those of you may know it as back in the day as Fame, the show Fame.
Fame.
That's the school that it was, you know, kind of like.
That's prestigious. Yeah. Now, did you audition to get in there?
I did. It's what they call in New York a specialized school, so mm-hmm. you have to audition or take a placement test to get in.
I see.
And, it was pretty rigorous.
So did you have to do the dance where you, like, fall over the cars and, like, in the street and all that?
No.
You don't do that every day?
No. Well, you know, a lot of people ask that question, and...
So I imagine this is a lively school where they're just dancing in the halls and everything.
Did we dance in the tables in the lunchroom? Yeah.
You
did? On a regular basis.
We have to.
But, you know, what was the funnest, the best part about being at that school is that, you know, especially if you were in your chorus classes and the bell would ring for you to go to your next class, people would sing. They wouldn't stop rehearsing whatever song just because the bell rang. They would just sing out the door.
Because music is
a
passion.
And it's always. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. So let me see. What sort of music do you like to perform best?
I think I'm more partial to the R&B, basically, just because I love the way that it just, the energy just kind of surges through and it projects. And I've had people tell me before that it just, you know, sometimes when I sing, it just really kind of affects them in a certain way. And that's really all I want to do, is just make sure that people feel good and feel the energy that I do. And, you know, whatever it is that I feel when I'm singing, that's what I'd like to project.
I see. So we've been talking a lot. Maybe we can hear a little bit. I'm putting
maybe,
you on the spot.
Maybe you are putting me on the spot, but that's okay.
You know, we have the listener. You were voted Pride Idol, you know, and...
I was.
I think our listeners deserve to hear the best of Pride
okay.
Idol.
I'll give you a little something.
Okay.
This is actually a little bit of one of the songs that I did for the finals, which is a song by Marvin Sapp.
Okay.
It's a song called Never Would Have Made It. So this is a little bit of that. Never would have made it. Never would have made it without you. I would have lost it all. And now I see you were there for me. And I can say, never would have made it. I never could have made it without you. I would have lost it all. And now I see you were always there for me.
Well, that sounded good to me. I don't know how that sounded to y'all, but...
It's a little rough, but...
I just put you on the spot.
On the spot.
That's amazing that voice comes out such a little body.
Oh, whatever.
Okay, let's recap. Let's give them the website.
The website for Houston Pride Idol is www.houstonprideidol.com.
Okay.
New information about next year's season will be posted. My MySpace page, myspace.com/PRSinger.
Mm-hmm. Your band.
My band, of course. Give a shout out to, quick shout out to all of my band members. and especially my girls, Lisa and Casey. I love them very much. And, you know, Abe, Jimmy, Jonathan, Clay and Frank.
They're all listening, I hope.
They're all listening. But that is www.musicbymidstream.com. And actually, you know, my email address is out there, prdragon05@yahoo.com. For those who are interested in Pride Idol and they just kind of want to talk to me about what, you know, the process is and how it works and all that stuff, I'd be more than willing to... talk to anybody about that, because part of my responsibility, of course, is to try and get an interest started, you know, and just tell people how much of an amazing experience I had throughout this whole deal. I mean, I had a blast. I'm really, it's weird because I'm really kind of sad that it's over.
Well, you know, you win and then that's it.
I know. It's like you go through all this anticipation of getting to the end, and then you get to the end and it's there and you're like, okay.
That's it.
Not there anymore.
Well, David, I very much appreciate you coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations
for having me.
To winning.
Thank you so much.
And be sure to check out his website and all those music producers out there. Give him a call.
Yeah,
this is some talented person here. Thank you, David.
Thank you so much, Brian.
All right.
I tried to call you before, but I lost my nerve.
If you take Jenny and change that into Tommy, then you have 867-5309, and actually the cover of a song that was produced by Tommy Two-Tone in 1982. That was Mark Weigel, and before that, another Mark Weigel with What I Like About You, both from 2003, the album Different and the Same. And coming up now, I Just Love Girls by Sugar Beach.
Thank you. as I am, there's really nothing to fear. You know, times have changed and I'm okay being queer. I say I'm here now and I'm queer now. You better get over it. I say I'm here now and I'm queer now. You better get over it.
Well, that was a fun song, and I would like to thank our gay musicologist. Who is it?
J.D. Doyle?
There you go. And, well, I just wanted to give you a chance to get a word in there. There you go. All right. Yeah. J.D. Doyle, I'd like to thank him, our gay musicologist, for bringing us that hot song. It's just hot off the press, brand new, and that was Gay Without Shame, Queer Blues, and the performing artist, Gay, let's see if I can get this right, Adegbola. There we go. Adegbola. And before that, Erasure, Walking in the Rain, from their 2003 CD, Other People's Songs. Now, here is the rest of This Way Out.
His unusual gay teen character may have disappeared at the Jersey Shore, but our reporter finds the author on the other coast later in the program. Gender issues are getting more and more exposure in the popular media, but that has not necessarily translated into more space for trans people speaking for themselves. Enter the award-winning playwright Tobias K. Davis. Davis is a trans man whose latest work, Standards of Care, found a world premiere home with the 20% Theater Company in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He and artistic director Claire Avitable spent some time with This Way Out correspondent Dixie Treichel.
Tobias, tell us about how you began the process of creating this play and what the main idea of it is.
There were a few different people that I knew in my life who were struggling with different issues that I found inspiring. This play is the story of two different female-to-male transgender individuals and the gender therapist who sort of connects their lives, even though she doesn't know it. There is David, who is an older F to M. He's in his 30s and further along in his transition, and he is back in therapy because he is pursuing bottom surgery and he needs a letter from a therapist in order to achieve that. And so he's seeing this therapist named Nancy. And meanwhile, Nancy has a daughter, Jessica, who is starting to explore her own identity and realizing more and more that she is also female to male and becoming this new character. Jason. Nancy is having a lot of trouble with that, even though she deals with trans people in her professional capacity. And she's also struggling because there is some romantic chemistry happening between her and David. And so this triangle sort of comes out of that dynamic when Jason goes to the local queer youth center and finds a mentor in David. So everybody knows everybody, but nobody knows that everybody knows everyone else. It's sort of a standard love triangle.
Female to male transgender characters. Why are those in the play?
I'm trans myself. And it's very important to me as an artist and as a trans person to create opportunities for trans people to be seen and to have their stories told. There's definitely an educational component to my work, but I also think that it's important to have plays that trans people can go to and say, yes, these are my stories.
The name of the play is Standards of Care. Tell us where that comes from.
There is a document which therapists in the United States are strongly encouraged to follow when treating transgender patients, which is called the Harry Benjamin Standards of Care. The real title's a little bit longer. It's basically a guidebook for, you know, how they're supposed to diagnose whether somebody is really, in fact, transgender, whatever that means, what sort of steps people need to follow in order to transition. And a lot of people in the trans community feel that it's kind of a very rigid document that doesn't allow for a lot of flexibility of identity and that requires some unrealistic things of trans people. For example, you know, that they try to live as the opposite sex without any hormones, without any surgery. And for some people, you know, the way they are physically, that's just not safe or reasonable. Mm-hmm. So part of what I wanted to do with the play is look at that process and critique that a little bit.
Is that process changing?
Definitely. There are a lot of people out there, trans people and mental health providers, who are working to change that. There are different guidelines popping up which are saying, you know, that trans people really are healthy and sane individuals who are capable of making informed decisions about what they want to do with their lives and their bodies without having to go through all these hoops. And I think that that's a really positive thing.
Tell us how you came to the conclusion that you were a trans person.
I was a first year in college, and I at that point was identifying as a lesbian because I had realized that I was attracted to women. There was this little epiphany where I was talking to a friend. I said something funny, and she thought that was funny and went to write it down and asked me what my name was, which was very feminine. And she said, "Oh, I just never associate that name with you." And I had this moment of, you know, me neither. She was like, "It's much too girly." And I was like, yeah, not only am I not girly, I'm not a girl. I'm not a woman. That's not something that I identify with. And it's like, uh-oh, what does that mean? So, but I was very, very fortunate in my experiences at Smith that there was a supportive trans community and ally community there. I struggled with some depression around that, too, because you feel like the whole world's got this gender thing figured out, and what's wrong with me that I don't? Gender is a social construct, and no one really fits into these sort of rigid gender roles that have been established, that there really is a lot more diversity to the gender experience.
The writing and producing of a play like yours concerning transgender issues, it gets this information out in a very creative way. They're not crazy, and they're not killing somebody, and... You know, is that some of your concerns while you're writing?
Definitely. I always set out to try to write plays where someone who knows nothing about the trans community and has never heard of anything transgender can come and sit down and watch the play and understand it and feel connected to these people because of the sort of basic human experiences that they're having, but also where someone who is trans can come in and say, yes, that's me, I relate to that, and see sort of an interesting story about somebody who's like them.
Claire, how did you get involved with this?
Toby and I went to Smith College together. It's a women's college in Western Massachusetts. He wrote a play with a lot of monologues that also dealt with the transgender community, and we co-directed it. It was a wonderful experience, and I really fell in love with his writing and with his stories and what he was trying to do.
Tell us about 20% Theater.
Our mission is to produce new and progressive work by female transgender and genderqueer theater artists, primarily plays written within the past 10 years or so. We focus on not necessarily having just women or trans people on stage, but making sure that they are employed behind the scenes as well. The name 20% Theater originally came from a study that the New York Council on the Arts did in 2002, which the results basically said that roughly only 20% of professionals in theater were women. We are always accepting script submissions and proposals to direct plays or be part of plays or design productions, create new works, etc. And all of this information can be found on our website, which is www.tc20%.org.
Tobias, tell us about your book.
I'm working on a novel for young adults right now that's about an FDM in a boarding school in high school. I really like teenage characters. There are two teenage characters in Standards of Care. Very fortunate to be friends with Ellen Whitlinger, who's a young adult novelist, and she's been helping me with the editing process. She just actually released a book called Parrotfish, which is a YA novel about a trans character. It's kind of the first F2M character in a young adult novel. I collaborated with her on that book. I was sort of her trans expert.
Is there a distinction between transgender and transsexual?
Language is sort of very fluid and always changing, so people have very personal connections to different definitions. The general use is that transgender is an umbrella term for anyone who transgresses traditional gender roles and identities. Transsexuals are generally folks who desire to live as the opposite sex they're assigned at birth. I like the term trans man when I'm describing myself. I'm a trans man because I think that I do identify as a man, but I have a trans history.
Are you finding that more is opening up for FTMs?
I think there are.
I think they're still pretty hidden.
It's not really a huge cohesive movement at this point, although there are a lot of people working really hard to increase awareness about FTM issues. I think one of the important things that the trans movement is doing is fighting for the rights of people to determine their own pronouns and have that be respected, and to determine their own names and have that be respected. I think that's really important. You know, and I think it really is a matter of respect. It's not about, is somebody convincing me enough that they are a man or a woman or whatever? It's about common courtesy and saying, oh, what would you like me to call you? And then respecting that.
That was trans man playwright and budding young adult novelist Tobias K. Davis. Dixie Trichel spoke with him and the 20% Theater Company's Claire Avitable in Minneapolis.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
This Way Out's roving reporter Steve Pride was at Book Expo America in Los Angeles a few weeks ago, where he found a relatively quiet corner to chat with author, actor, activist James Lacine. The man behind the Academy Award-winning film Trevor and the hotline of the same name was there to promote his first novel, Absolute Brightness, The Mystery of Leonard Pelkey.
What's it about?
It's a coming-of-age story. It's written in the voice of a 15-year-old girl. She lives on the Jersey Shore in Neptune, New Jersey, and it's one summer when her cousin, her 14-year-old sort of pre-gay flaming queen cousin, comes to live with them, and he gets connected to everybody's life in the community and upsets her, and then he disappears. And the book is really about her trying to figure out what happened to him and where he went.
This is your first book. Why did you suddenly decide to become an author?
I actually started as an actor and a writer, and I would travel around the country doing these monologues, playing these different characters, and I just thought maybe I could write a really long monologue and not have to actually show up every night to do it. And also, I felt that there was something that I wanted to say about the nature of good and evil. I actually didn't write this book as a young adult novel. I started to write it actually as a kind of, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird or Member of the Wedding kind of book, and something that dealt with some social issues, because I was sort of fascinated by this whole thing that's happening in the world where people are either evildoers or they're good people, you know, that there's a way in which everything's getting divided up into either you're good or you're evil. And I felt that a novel was the right way to be able to deal with the complexities of character and bring out the fact that each of us has within us the capacity for evil and each of us has the capacity for goodness.
How did you feel about that when you thought you wrote one particular genre and then you said, oh, look, a young adult novel?
Well, I don't think anybody actually starts out writing for young adults, you know, really. I think what you do is you write a book and then you find that people can sell it in a particular way. And that's great, because to be perfectly honest, I've ended up in this world of young adults. And as you probably know, I wrote a film called Trevor, and I founded the Trevor Project, which is the only 24-hour suicide prevention helpline for gay and lesbian teenagers nationwide. And so I have, like, some kind of connection to young adults, and especially, I think, to gay teens. But I wanted to write something that would include more than just gay teens, that would actually include kids who are dealing with issues of that they know gay teens or that maybe they're related to a gay teen. So I created this character.
What inspired this particular story?
I think it's very hard to figure out where any story comes from, except that there are some parallels in our own life. And I come from New Jersey, so it seemed like a logical setting to set it in New Jersey. And I've had amazing times on the Jersey Shore, so I suppose it comes from it in that sense. But other than that, it came from my imagination.
What do you want readers to take away from the book?
I would just hope that they would be able to have a conversation and a dialogue about the complexity of good and evil, and also the complexity of assigning labels on people, especially in the young adult world, like labels about sexuality. And, you know, before young people are able to actually figure out what and who they are.
Now, you mentioned the Trevor Project. Tell us a little bit about how that all began.
I wrote a film in 1994. It was called Trevor, and it's about a 13-year-old boy who, through a series of diary entries, he discovers that he's gay, and he tries to commit suicide. And it's very funny, and it's also very touching and, you know, heartbreaking, but he lives. And when we sold the film to HBO to put on TV, they suggested that we might want to find something like a 800 number that a kid could call if they saw the film out in the Midwest somewhere and they related to Trevor. And when we investigated, we found that there was no suicide prevention helpline specifically for gay and lesbian teenagers, which meant, you know, we went away and created it. And that was 10 years ago. You know, it's been an amazing experience because of the people who've been involved. And we have a big fundraiser in L.A. and in New York every year. And we get about 1,500 calls a month. Lately, our volume has been going up. I think the statistics are pretty alarming, which is that gay teens are three to four times more likely to commit suicide than their heterosexual peers. It's just the lack of support, especially in the Midwest and in the South, continues to be really alarming, where these kids don't have any options. So sometimes Trevor is the only way that they have to connect to anybody, to a friendly ear. And, you know, we don't really actually do anything except listen to kids and try to offer them the realization that they should wait. You know, that not to make a permanent solution to a temporary problem is what we say.
Now you're out and about meeting teens, promoting your book. What kind of response have you had from teenagers to Absolute Brightness?
It's been good. You know, I think one of the things that kids are very keen, you know, they're very smart, especially reading teens, and they're not easily fooled. They're very attuned to, like, truth-telling. So one of the things that they like about the book is that not everything is sewed up so neatly, that there's some ambiguity to the characters, and there is what I think is, you know, complexity, which they like. They don't like labels to be put on people and, you know, decide who's good and who's evil, that there's some questions involved.
What do you enjoy most? What do you see yourself doing tomorrow?
I think all of the things that I do have to do with telling the story, whether it's the Trevor Project, whether it's, you know, allowing teens to actually tell their story to people, or me telling my stories, or, you know, being an actor telling other people's stories, or being a screenwriter and, you know, making a story. It's really about story, and it's about the power of story in all of our lives, and it's the thing that we can kind of gather around to find meaning. And I just don't understand what I would do with my life if I didn't have the outlet to be able to actually tell stories or to listen to them. I think it's how we come together as a people.
From Book Expo America, we've been talking to James Lacine, author of Absolute Brightness and founder of the Trevor Project. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
You can find The Trevor Project online at www.thetrevorproject.org. The U.S. helpline number is 1-800-4-U-T-R-E-V-O-R. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Christopher Gall, Steve Levin, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Dixie Treichel, and Steve Pride contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep us on the air. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of all of our programs there. To receive weekly email alerts describing the content of each This Way Out, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening on KDUR Durango, Colorado, 3BBB Ballarat, Victoria, WVEW Brattleboro, Vermont, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Y'all stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Well, we wrapped up Pride and we wrapped up the 4th of July.
Right.
So now we're just into the heading
What's
into
next?
The dog days of summer,
yep.
As they call it.
Dog days, okay.
Well, we're sort of anxiously waiting for Outsmart to come out to see what's going on.
Yes, I don't know
July.
What to do.
We're kind of in the lurch until we get our Outsmart. And
that's right.
And know what's happening. But some changes.
Well, what's happening next week?
Well, we'll get to that in a minute.
Oh.
But we just want to remind folks that next week, instead of tuning into Queer Voices, when you tune in, you will hear coverage of the Green Party Convention, the National Green Party Convention, which is taking place in Chicago, in Illinois. And then
Ralph Nader's supposed to be.
No, he's not with the Green Party.
They threw him out.
They kicked him out.
They threw him out?
He's running as an independent.
What do you do, buy a Hummer?
You know, I think he secretly bought all the Corvairs.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, and after that, starting July 21st, Queer Voices will start at 9 p.m. and continue to 11 p.m., which will mean that we'll be doing a little bit of tweaking with how we do things on the show, and we might not be able to have as many live interviews. We might have to pre-record them and play them in the later hour.
Some people will go to sleep.
Well, the good thing is you can download the show off of iTunes, so you can listen to it.
You're never without Queer Voices,
yes,
because you can go to the archives at kpft.org or the iTunes thing, which I still don't know how to
do. Well, you can get up in the morning. Yeah, you can get up in the morning and play it in the morning.
Yeah, do a search on iTunes.
While you're getting ready for work.
And JD will continue to do Queer Music Heritage and providing us with music for our programs. He's got one that we didn't get to play when we were preempted before. That's the history of Olivia Records. So maybe we'll get that on sometime.
Good.
And I've already forgotten what it is that he's got planned for this month, but it's something good that he's going to have for Queer Music Heritage. And as the month progresses, we've got all of July booked. Got many interesting and exciting programming things happening.
There's all sorts of things coming up.
There's always something, you know.
I want to mention that I heard this really good interview today on Talk of the Nation.
I thought you were going to say you heard a really good rumor.
I heard that too, but
that'd
I can't
be juicy. Yeah,
talk
yeah.
about it on the air.
Oh.
It's called A Big Sort. A gentleman from Austin named Bill Bishop wrote this book about how homogeneous the neighborhoods are these days, and that because they're so homogeneous, we're not all like getting along in this country, because there's not only the red and blue states, there's really the red and blue neighborhoods.
No.
And it's over the past number of years that people pretty much are like-minded Americans are, you know, sort of tearing the country apart. We all know about this that are active in politics, but you know, you don't really get to discuss things with your neighbors because they, you know, of different persuasions, because pretty much your neighbors are all alike. And I mean, in a way, some of that's good to have the gay neighborhoods and stuff, but how do you really, you know, get to discuss different viewpoints? And you can listen to it online at go to npr.org and just go to Talk of the Nation, and it was on today.
I think that's very true, though. I mean, especially in Houston, it seems like the Inner Loop is very blue and the suburbs are just this big red.
Well, and I went to this demographer's talk a couple weeks ago, and interestingly enough, though, the metropolitan area of Houston is probably one of the most diverse of all metropolitan areas across the country. Houston and Los Angeles are most diverse, and Detroit's probably the least diverse. If you actually put up a map and show which majority, whether it's Caucasians, Black, Hispanic, or Asians, there's more of a sort of coloring, or less of a sort of heavy coloring of different groups in Houston and in L.A. compared to a lot of other communities around the country.
We have more mixed neighborhoods.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, there still are majority-minority neighborhoods in the Houston metropolitan areas, but it's much less than a lot of other...
That's those Republican ones.
now, we don't... you know, there are some places I drive around and I think, oh, gosh, my bumper stickers are going to get me in trouble.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, you're pretty liberal with your bumper stickers.
Yeah, I mean, I go over to West U and I'm like, oh, I don't know.
And
yeah.
That includes the KPFT bumper
sticker. Well, I was going to say that the KPFT sticker on your car instantly, you know.
Identifies you as.
That's right.
Well, you feel
hippie
a bond,
liberal.
Though, when you see another one.
That's right. I wave at him. See a car with a KPF sticker on it, I wave at him.
Yeah.
Because we know, little thumbs up.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, we need to thank our guests that were on tonight.
Yeah. Tim Brookover.
leaving OutSmart after 7 years, did a tremendous job, really brought that magazine into, I think, one of the classiest publications I've ever seen. David Elliott from Washington, D.C.
We also had David Bermudez, the winner of Pride Idol this year.
Yeah.
And he sang a little song, yeah.
Yeah, that was great. And, of course, we have This Way Out, which is something that comes to us. We would like to be able to say it comes to us free, but it doesn't, in the sense that they have to have support to continue their work, just like KPFT has to have support to continue the work here. So if you've made a pledge, please pay it. And if you haven't made one, you can always go online at kpft.org. And you're listening to Queer Voices.
Brian, do you want to say something about Facebook?
Yes. We have a new Facebook group. If you're on Facebook, just do a search on Queer Voices. And we also have a new MySpace page, myspace.com/queervoices.
Oh, boy, we're just in, so up
we
there.
We are in the 21st century.
We are technologically savvy here.
Oh. So if you're one of them youngins and you know what all that means.
Well, you know, we're not age discriminatory here. You know,
I'm going to learn all that stuff.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, we need to go where the listeners are. So.
Well, that's right. You want to know what's on next week?
Well, the scary part is that
you
get to
us.
See what we look like.
Don't you have the rundown for next week?
I have the rundown for next week.
Well, next week is nothing.
That's right. Next week is nothing. That was
the
easy.
Week after that.
It's the week after that. It's the week after that. The week after that, Donna Garrett and Jim Sade join us to talk about the showing of their paintings at Jim's Shop. And Jim's shop is called Bead Atelier. And also Donna Garrett's upcoming poetry reading on July 25th, which is sort of a Christmas in July program. And then we also have Joan Devlin from Iowa, who will be interviewing author Paul Fisher, who grew up in Wyoming and has quite an education and is the author of Artful Itineraries. And then we also have Paul Hidalgo with SNAP, the Spay-Neuter Assistance Program, who will talk with Brian Levinka about the Animal Aid Program. And remember that Queer Voices will be preempted next week by Pacifica's coverage of the Green Party Convention from Chicago. And then after that, the plan is to move the show 1 hour later in the evening so that we will be starting at 9 p.m. on Monday nights. Have been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Walensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Walensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Number 22 is coming Saturday, July 26th. Number 22 features Giant Bear from Tennessee. Local artists Opie Hendrix, David Fall, Los Vertigos, Pot Roast, The Hightailers, and many more. Number 22 is a benefit concert for KPFT. Number 22 is the 22nd annual Watermelon Dance and Summer Social. The event is held at the Last Concert Cafe, 1403 Nant Street, just off the Hardy McKee exit on I-10 in the heart of downtown. 713-226-8563 gets you details. Dawn and David promise a great time for all. Number 22 starts around 2 p.m. So come on down, meet your friends, and dance in the sand. And enjoy a slice of the other red meat. Icy cold watermelon. See you Saturday, July 26th at the Last Concert Cafe for number 22, a Houston classic. Supporting 90.1 KPFT Houston.
In this presidential election year, huge issue.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston.
If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.